Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross. For 80 years, Capital Blue Cross has offered products that provide peace of mind and promote good health, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Health and Wellness Centers that provide in-person service and inspire healthy living. Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, who has offered transapical mitral valve repair procedures for more than 3 years and currently serves as a trial site for over 50 clinical trials. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. People with intellectual disabilities are sexually assaulted at 7 times the rate of people without disabilities. It's a crime that often goes unrecognized and unpunished. That's how a groundbreaking investigation by NPR began last week. At a time when many women have talked about being sexually assaulted or harassed as part of the Me Too movement, we haven't heard much about what may be the most vulnerable population. We want to continue to shine a light on this topic on today's Smart Talk. Joining us is Nancy Thaler, who is Deputy Secretary for the Office of Developmental Programs at the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services, Kristen Hauser, Chief Public Affairs Officer, Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape, and Marie Cronin, Executive Director of the ARC of Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org.
The two boys took a baths on me. I didn't like it at all.
They took what?
They took a baths on me.
Took advantage of you.
That was part of the NPR series last week. Pauline, it's a woman who has intellectual disabilities. She's in her 40s. She lives in northeastern Pennsylvania. She was raped by two boys, 12 and 13 years old, living in the same household as she was. And her story does not end happily, not that it's ever going to, but probably one of the sadder stories you'll hear, in that the woman who she called mommy protected the boys, who one of them was her son. Marie Cronin, I'm going to start with you. Pauline's story. Have you heard stories like that before?
Absolutely. And sadly, I've been in this field a very long time. And even when I first started, we had lots of stories and incidences. But now we believe it's an epidemic. But the good news is for Pauline, she's supported by one of our chapters, the ARC of Northeastern Pennsylvania. And they feel very honored to support her. And they've had to do trauma-informed care. And they've really seen her grow and blossom. She is in such a better place than when she first came to them.
And during the report, during the NPR report, she said that she wanted to speak up because she wanted people to know her story, in hopes that it would help other people. Secretary Thaler, you were part of that series. In fact, you were a part of it extensively, and you're familiar with Pauline's story. What can you tell us about Pauline and people, you know, so many people like her?
So I don't want to talk much more about Pauline than we heard her say herself and invade her privacy anymore, but I think she speaks for thousands of people. The victimization is high because folks with developmental disabilities are disadvantaged in a number of ways. And one of them is that they have difficulty communicating. And when they do communicate, people don't often believe them. So perpetrators see them as a perfect victim. Oftentimes, they're physically easy to overpower and threaten. And I think what also contributes to this is that adults with developmental disabilities are not raised to have a sense of autonomy and personal control. So from early childhood, particularly if they have any illnesses, they're touched by doctors, they're touched by therapists, they're touched by caregivers, and their privacy is invaded to a greater extent than the typical child. And so when that happens over time, if people don't say, "May I touch you?" pretty soon you're letting people touch you without asking. And so that also makes people vulnerable, which means The solution has to be sort of multifaceted. It's how we raise children, in fact, all children, and being very conscious about raising children with disabilities to have personal control over their bodies and as I like to say, teach defiance, not compliance. We celebrate when a child says no, not punish them when they say no, because that's what gives them personal power. So lots of things contribute to the victimization that Pauline experienced, and it is, any of us that have worked in the field for any given amount of time know this is true. Inevitably, when we have private conversations, particularly with women with developmental disabilities, they will reveal the abuse. I think many of us I am personally enormously relieved by this national report because it gets it all out in the open.
You touched on some of these, but why is it that you think that this, as NPR described it, is an epidemic that has not been discussed?
Prejudice. This is the most disenfranchised group of citizens in the United States. These are the folks who didn't even get to walk into a public schoolroom until 1976, and only then because there was a court order and a congressional action. So, and up until then, locked in institutions. Institutions, we should remember, are founded in the eugenics movement for the very purpose of isolating people and sterilizing them. And it's not until the 1980s when people started to get out of institutions. So for all these decades, people have been hidden, segregated, and not educated. So if any child not receiving any education isn't going to learn to speak up for themselves. And I think all of this has changed. When children started going to public school, it means now all children are raised in families. All kids go to public school. Their siblings go to public school with them. They meet children in public school. They transition into the workforce. They're out in public. There's hardly a person who doesn't know a person with intellectual disabilities now, because you see them in the grocery store or at church or they're a neighbor. And so as people have been part of the community, their view of them is changing, and they are gaining skills and competencies that people did not have two decades ago. And oddly enough, the theory that if you put everybody in one place isolated, you make them safer is paradoxically false. That what makes people safe is being part of the community, being known, having a social network, having people care about you. So I think that the Right of Education and the Americans with Disability Act, which pushed us to get people out of institutions, is what's making people safe, because they're known. Siblings are incredible allies. And the truth is that now we're meeting policemen and district attorneys and prosecutors and nurses who have siblings with developmental disabilities. So their view of them is different, and they're more inclined to believe people. So I think, you know, as I said, the Right to Education and the ADA are paying off in many ways. And one of them is people are part of our community now, and it makes them safer.
Kristen, the two of us have spoken many times because, unfortunately, there have been too many different kind of situations, incidents that we can discuss. But, you know, it's funny because when I say funny, not ha-ha, but ironic, last week when NPR did the first installment of this series, which is excellent, by the way, and you can hear it on NPR's website. We'll have a link on our website, wytf.org. I've heard the first installment. I thought, we got to talk about this in Smart Talk. Half hour later, I get an email from you saying, we have to talk about this on Smart Talk.
Yep.
How aware was the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape that this was occurring with so much frequency?
We have been very aware. We've been working for more than a decade with our community partners who are providing services to people with intellectual disabilities. Been working with the Disability Rights Network, the Department of Health, Temple Institute on Disabilities, our local rape crisis centers and domestic violence shelters, because people need services in the community. So this has actually been a topic that that PCAR and frankly the field of sexual assault providers have been encountering now for, and I think paying good attention to, 15, 20 years.
But have you, over the years, gotten phone calls? I mean, there's a hotline. Mm-hmm. Have you gotten phone calls from families or from people with intellectual disabilities who have said, you know, I've been raped or I've been assaulted?
It's a great question. I can't answer what kind of hotline calls we get, but what we normally see is that when you're working to support a person with intellectual disabilities who has been victimized, it's not just working with that person or their family, but you need to be coordinating your services across a spectrum of providers, because oftentimes people are getting their medical benefits from one place, they're getting assisted living care from another. You've got a lot of systems that are involved in the person's life, and you need to be coordinating care among everybody, including getting support for somebody to get counseling if that's what they're looking for, to get safe housing if that's what they need, support if they are going through the criminal court system. And those are the kinds of things that we can provide, but we're not in a position to provide specialized care in terms of day-to-day living, and that's why you need to be coordinating with your other partners.
If I could jump in, the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape and my office, the Office of Developmental Disabilities, and the Temple Institutes on Disability and Protective Services have partnered over the last couple of years. PCAR got a grant, and we partnered together, designed, and have been producing training across the state for people who work in local rape crisis centers, for the case managers in our system, for people who work in the DA's office. And the training's been twofold: to surface the problem so people know the problem, and two, so people learn about each other's roles, because it takes more than one entity to solve the problem, because it's not just prosecution, it's not just immediate treatment and detection, there's the follow-up services. So this joint partnership has been going on for quite a while and is really pretty effective.
Mm-hmm. Maureen Cronin, you work with families.
I do.
It would seem as though, and just from what Kristen described, when there are a lot of different agencies, organizations, and families involved, that in a situation like this where the victim is a person with an intellectual disability, that it would take more family support than, I hate to say, your typical or your, you know, another. Put it this way, a sexual assault on a person living without an intellectual disability. Is that true?
Well, we should talk about what the experiences is for families as they support their children. You know, their children are born, they're told early on that they have a disability. They start thinking in their minds what their child's life is going to be like. They start worrying about education and childcare. And some of these adult issues, they really put off, and they try not to think too much about, because they have so many other responsibilities, medical care, therapists. And so, you know, over time, we try to help families see how important it is to understand that their child will grow up and will be a sexual being, and to have those difficult conversations. And it really starts even with early intervention. So my son received early intervention services, and he had very significant disabilities. But we learned right from the beginning that even though he didn't speak, he did communicate. He did give eye gaze. He moved his head. He showed what he liked and what he didn't like. And to start honoring that, and then to continue with that mode of communication. So, you know, we're blessed now. We have people with disabilities who have voices, who are speaking up. We learn from them. We learn what it's like for people who don't have voices. And so the same thing happens for both in terms of helping families understand what the incidences are, what they can do to prevent it. We do at the ARC a significant amount of training within schools to help teachers know what to look for and what to do. It is a growing discussion, and I can't thank you enough for having this discussion today.
Well, as I said, as soon as I heard the NPR report, this is something that we have to shine a light on and talk about more often. But you know, something you just said about parents, family thinking about the childhood programs, education, that kind of thing. You almost get the sense that sometimes, well, put it this way, I almost get the sense, my observation, is that people with intellectual disabilities are often treated as children. And that some of the adult problems that they will encounter are not discussed or addressed. Now, let's face it, the parents very often are probably doing this because they want to keep their children safe. They want to make sure that they're taken care of. But is that the case? I mean, are they often treated as children?
So I think, and I'm a mom too, I think that parents in general would keep their children, whether disabled or not, as children, right? Parents generally think of their adult children as their
children. Not teenagers, but
And so the difference is that children with developmental disabilities can't push back the way kids without disabilities can. So they can't run away from home. They can't walk out of the house. So they're more, they succumb more to the that relationship of child to parent than typical children do. No parent generally wants to think about sexuality.
I was just
Many
say
parents
that.
Avoid the topic.
Us kids don't want to think about the parents.
Exactly, exactly. And so, and there is also an underlying prejudice, myth, assumption that people with disabilities are not sexual, and or maybe a hope that they are not. And the truth is that sex happens very deep in the brain. It happens where eating is and where sleeping is and where walking is. It's an innate instinct that we have. And so families, on top of everything else they have to do with their children with disability, have to do also that. They have to recognize their child as a sexual being. So do schools, so do caregivers, so that people not just get sex education so they're not abused. That's an important outcome. But so that they can be sexual beings, so that they can have relationships.
That are healthy.
Healthy and enjoy that like everyone else. I will say, in the last few years, I have seen parents supporting this, including supporting marriage and lifelong relationship. Not a lot, but it's beginning to happen, and those families and those people become role models for other folks.
We have to think about how, when we talk about what a child's life is going to be like. So sometimes our medical profession, when they try to tell a parent what it's going to be like to raise this child, might use terms that they think might be helpful, but they're not. I have a friend who, when she was young, her father was told that she will always be like an 8-year-old. You know, when she turned 21 and wanted to have a boyfriend, the father really could not get his head around that because he was told she's going to be like an 8-year-old.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle. Its 11 principal investigators and 12 nurse coordinators conduct research efforts to advance cardiovascular medicine. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.
On today's program, we're following up on an NPR series that began last week and continues this week that you can have access to it if you go to their website, WITF.org, that really, I call it groundbreaking, but I think it's something that it's not often when you find a national media source that can bring something to light like this, and that is that the incidences of the people living with intellectual disabilities who are the victims of sexual assault. And that's our conversation today with our guest, Nancy Thaler, who is Deputy Secretary for the Office of Developmental Programs at the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services, Maureen Cronin, Executive Director of the ARC of Pennsylvania, Kristen Hauser, Chief Public Affairs Officer with the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Kristen, in the past, when we've spoken on the air about different situations, you know, one of the things that we do know that the statistics do show is that most often someone who has been sexually assaulted knew the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that the NPR report pointed out is that when the victim is a person with an intellectual disability, that it is even more likely that they knew the perpetrator, right?
Right. That's correct. That's correct. If you think about sexual assault, which I know I'm weird that I do that all the time, but you need to look at what we know about perpetration. And perpetration is not a static thing that there's a single motivation for. So some people are taking advantage of opportunities. Some people are creating opportunities. Some people are acting on preferences. If we consider the relationships that people who have intellectual disabilities are required to have for their daily living. That could be assistance with bathing, with dressing, having people touching them, help with mobility, transportation. You are reliant on many, many people in your life to help you get through and get through your day, get to work, get to your schooling, etc. Those are all of those things open up numerous opportunities where a caregiver is alone with a person, and oftentimes doing things that are much more personal than people without disabilities have. Most of us dress ourselves, we take care of our bodily functions by ourselves, we, you know, our medical care, like we're able to move ourselves around, etc. So there are always there's so many opportunities in daily life that if somebody is looking for an opportunity to exploit, they are readily available. When you couple that with perhaps having difficulty in communicating, and you're part of a population that people don't look at as sexual, don't look at as being believable, maybe are labeled as seeking attention or other sort of like myths that actually are like normal behavior. We all like to get attention. It makes it really easy for perpetrators to single out the people who are least likely to be believed and least likely to tell. Oftentimes, perpetrators have other kinds of good, beneficial parts to the relationship, and then the sexual abuse is the yucky part. So there may be a friendship, there may be true affection, there may be other kinds of benefits that are being given to the victim. And you know, we see this in grooming as well. Adults with kids use the same kind of tactics, you know, that if you're getting a benefit, you get a special privilege, you get to go someplace special. Do something you've wanted to do. Those are confusing relationships to navigate, and you have adults that are taking advantage of this disability, of the limitation, of the beneficial relationship, and exploiting that by when they're causing the sexual harm.
You know, one of the, again, I keep referring back to the NPR report because there's so much that we did learn in it, but something that was reported there is that it happens. I'm not sure that this is accurate, but it does happen often in a group home or an institution, maybe more so than in when they're living with their family, when a person with intellectual disabilities is living with their own family or another family. This would seem hard to control because, just as Kristen described, there often is a one-on-one relationship there. And I mean, it shows one of the reasons that the people who work in those settings, mm-hmm. That, you know, you have to look into their backgrounds very closely, well, and that kind of thing.
You do, but keep in mind, background checks only will detect things that have been reported in the past.
Right, right.
So if you are perpetrating on a population that's unlikely to report in the first place and unlikely to be believed in the second place, you're not going to end up with a vast record of past bad behavior. So you want employers to be putting in other kinds of trainings and protections as well. And like, for instance, if it's possible to limit the one-on-one unsupervised time, like, can you have more people around? How can you, perhaps with some people, help with autonomy in terms of dressing and bathing and other things so that we're lessening the opportunities? What kind of education are we giving and giving communication abilities? Because even if you can't speak verbally, there are other ways. There you can use symbols and other sorts of communication tools to help people, but you have to give them the right tools to be able to talk about those things.
Also, less people think that if their child's not in a group home, they're safer. A couple of points. The Department of Justice data did not include people who live in group homes or institutions. Secondly, we estimate there are about 200,000 people in Pennsylvania who have developmental disabilities. 11,000 of them live in group homes. Yeah. Everybody else is out in the community.
I don't want to make it sound like a group home a dangerous place. Just saying that during that report, it said that often these happen. They don't have the statistics, but that often, anecdotally, it does happen behind the closed doors of an institution or a group
home.
And
I do want to address that, but I just, we don't want to suggest that everybody else is safer because we don't know that. And so whether people are living with their families and going to day programs that we fund
right.
or employment programs, I mean, we have to be as vigilant in our service system with people not living in group homes as we do in group homes. And absolutely, people are, in a sense, very vulnerable because there is so much touching, there's so much personal care, there are so many interactions. Our data, of course, is only based on the people that we know and the people that report. One of the things I wanted to share is we provided a lot of data to Joe Shapiro for this report. And one of the things we noticed was that of the reports that we get, only 6%, 6.5% are coming from the victim themselves. They're predominantly coming from people who observe often other workers in the mm-hmm. home or someone else. And so people's safety is so dependent on all of the workers being vigilant. And I want to talk about another complication in this, is that given the rate of sexual abuse in our culture, very often the people providing care in these arrangements have been victims themselves. They may be victims who never reported it or never had treatment. And so it complicates their role in this, and that perhaps denial is part of it because it's a way of suppressing my own victimization. And so our providers who provide service, when they surface this issue and teach about it, have to be prepared to deal with the trauma of their workers as they're teaching them to keep people safe and address the trauma of the people who they're serving.
That's a good point.
A lot has been happening for our group homes, and they're having very difficult conversations, like, we're going to put up cameras now. We're going to teach staff looking for signs. We're going to teach people how to tell till somebody listens. And so there's such a more aggressive approaches now as more people are becoming aware of this. And I think families now are having conversations about, there's even a case of a family who are suing to have their child be able to carry a camera to school every day. They think it's a First Amendment right that he should be able to talk about his day at school like anyone else. But it's obviously for protections and safety, too.
Mm-hmm. You know, Secretary, you said that only 6% of these cases are reported by the victim themselves. Most often it's other people, family members, co-worker, people who work in those settings. I want to bring up another statistic. Actually, Pennsylvania has one of the higher rates of confirming sexual assaults. A little more than a third are confirmed. Now, that compares with Texas, where less than 1% are confirmed, Florida about 5%. Now, of the Pennsylvania cases, 40% were referred to law enforcement. Now, I want to ask about some terminology there. First of all, what does confirmed mean? Is it just that there's been a report and you believe
Correct.
that there has been an assault?
The result of the investigation was that there was indeed an assault, and then typically it is referred to law enforcement. The reason our data is so much higher than the other states, both in, I think, the number of reports and the number of confirmations, is that the Office of Developmental Disabilities has had a very robust system of incident reporting over the last 15 years. Everything's got to be reported, and when it's not reported, there are serious sanctions. So it means that we are more likely, maybe, than other states to get the information. And I have to say, this is all a consequence, or our success in this area is a consequence of a handful of state employees who are absolutely committed to knowing and finding out and investigating and doing something about it. So what we don't know is whether or not our confirmation number is high enough. And I don't think the referral and prosecution number is high enough. We look better than the other states that were referenced, but we have a lot more work to do. Since this is a Pennsylvania show and there are a lot of Pennsylvanians listening, and I think it's important to talk about sort of systemically how we think about this and how we are thinking about this. First of all, the training that we're doing with our partners, we're going to keep doing so that rape crisis centers and case managers and people in the system are alert and know what to do. We fund a group of individuals with developmental disabilities called Self Advocates United as One, and we fund them to do empowerment sessions. So they go around the state with a therapist, and they meet with people with developmental disabilities, intellectual disabilities, and talk to them and give them an opportunity to talk openly, and inevitably someone self-reports. And so we are trying to strengthen the voices of people in the system. Every year we ask self-advocates during their annual meeting, we make sure they know what their rights are, that they have a right to report, that they have a right to be free from abuse. That process and form was designed by people with intellectual disabilities. I think recently, in addition to our incident management system, our Governor Wolf was very progressive and generous this year with a significant expansion to our program. And part of that expansion is new services. One is to make sure that everybody's got community connections. In fact, the service is called community participation. And the design of the service is to get people engaged and involved in their community, developing personal relationships, broadening their social network, because the more people they know and the more people who know them and like them and share things in common, the safer they are. And we're also now able to support people to live where they want, with whom they want, and our services now can financially support a married couple living together. So the solutions have to be multifaceted, and we have a leadership role. Our partner associations have leadership roles. It's going to take everybody working on this to make progress.
I want to hear Pauline again.
She's a woman with an intellectual disability.
Okay.
She wanted to tell her story on the radio.
Stop right there. One of the things that Pauline said that she encouraged people to call the police if there was anything that did happen. That 40% prosecution, you said that you don't know whether that's high enough or not. Kristen, I don't know whether you know this figure or not, but how often, what percentage of sexual assault reports are actually prosecuted?
I just only looked yesterday. That's not really a statistic that is kept and published very readily. The NPR report yesterday was talking about how very difficult it can be because of so many of these other barriers. So the prosecution rates are not high.
I meant overall, not just
For all sexual assaults?
Right.
Well, if we're talking about adult sexual assault, somewhere between 80% and 60% of all those sexual assaults are never even reported to the police. So figuring out what the prosecution rate is a very difficult thing. You have to work backwards. So they're not reported. Some may not be thoroughly investigated. Some may not be charged. Some may be charged to lesser counts that don't necessarily qualify as a sexual assault. Mm-hmm. Others then plead out. So when we look at like how many actually get into the system where you end up like in front of a judge and jury, it's a extremely low percentage. And then conviction can be even lower. There's some statistics that say conviction is like 2%, but they're rather old and not terribly reliable. It's a hard figure to come up with, but I think it's fair to say in all sexual assault cases, the majority are not landing in the court system.
Well, then I wanted to follow up with Secretary Thaler. It's probably even less likely to end up in the court system when the victim is someone who has an intellectual disability. Okay, you mentioned earlier, you all have described how police officers, the courts, prosecutors are being trained now to recognize this. Many of them have relatives, family members living with an intellectual disability. But what are some of the challenges that a prosecutor has going into a courtroom, and how is it different? How is a person living with an intellectual disability, how are they dealt with in the court system that may be different than someone who doesn't have an intellectual disability?
Well, when you think about the very few people who do actually file suit, pursue it without disability.
Okay, when you say file suit, you mean civil?
Civil, yeah. Okay, or report it to the police or do any kind of action. Those people are extraordinary. They're extraordinary in terms of their own courage and their own ability to stand up for themselves. And you have a person with intellectual disabilities, it's extraordinarily hard. It's, I think... you know, lawyers talk about how to get a witness, how much they prep for the court hearing, how much they go over the facts, how important it is to be able to say the facts the same exact way to be able to win the case. So a person with intellectual disabilities has a lot going against them. Some really breakthrough things, though, are certainly DNA. That really is a game changer for people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. But also, we now know how to do trauma-informed care. So we know how to support somebody so that they can tell their story, so that they're able to do it in a way that is consistent and a prosecutor could win.
And I also understand that what they are doing in some jurisdictions is when there, you know, is a person with an intellectual disability that has said they are sexually assaulted, that they will handle them much like they do child victims. Mm-hmm. They'll kind of take them into a setting where it's different than a courtroom where, you know, there's some things that make them familiar. I saw you shaking your head.
Yes, you're right. The NPR series included coverage of the New Jersey prosecution and extensive interviews with the prosecutor, and I think he said it all.
When you say the New Jersey prosecutor, there was a famous case from like 20 years ago that DNA actually helped to solve, but now there's a current case involving where the victim was a person living with intellectual disability.
And that prosecutor articulated over and over again, it's difficult, but it's possible. It's harder, but you have to stay with it. And I think that personal commitment to the person and to this population will bring out prosecutors like that who are willing to take the time. That series, that episode also described how the victim was handled, and not like a child, but using some of the support structures that
and they
we
made
use
that point
children.
Of saying not like a child, but using some of the same
it's,
support.
It's really best practice for all sexual assault cases. You know, like the sexual assault, like any traumatic event, it could be a car accident, it could be having a weapon pulled on you. Same thing from veterans that are coming back. What we know is that experiencing those assaults and experiencing or those experiences when you feel like your life may be at risk or your physical integrity is at risk, it changes our memory processing. So keeping your facts in linear order becomes much more difficult. The area of the brain that associates language with the sensory memory information may shut down. So you don't always have words to express the things that you may be able to remember. It's very normal for stories to vary with each telling. So when you give victims the opportunity to tell their story one time and have members of the different systems observe, it lessens the likelihood of having like one little detail here or another detail there be out of whack. We know that's normal for there to be inconsistencies. But the other difficulty for all sexual assault victims, but particularly for people with disability, intellectual disabilities who go into the criminal court system, is a jury. So the jury is the community at large. It's why programs like this and the NPR series are so important. We need jurors to recognize that these things do happen, that people may communicate differently, that delayed disclosure is normal, that partial disclosure is normal, that the way the words somebody uses may be different than the way you think you would tell it yourself. So we need to be continually doing public education, because that is truly jury pool education. And you want a DA to think that their community will be willing to hear these kinds of cases.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We're talking about the incidences of people living with intellectual disabilities who are the victims of sexual assault, something that NPR really highlighted in a groundbreaking series that they produced last week, and it continues into this week. If you have a question or comment during our conversation, like to join in, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Our guest, Kristen Hauser, Chief Public Affairs Officer with the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape, Nancy Thaler, Waters, the Deputy Secretary for the Office of Developmental Programs at the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services. Marie Cronin is Executive Director of the Arc of Pennsylvania. Again, the phone number 1-800-729-7532. We have an email from someone who actually worked at Arc. Says, when I began work at ARC, which provided residential services, after I graduated from college in 1981, no one talked about this. There were certainly suspicions of abuse to those I worked with, who I worked with developmental disabilities. What do we do now about those suspicions? What about statute of limitations? Should we recommend some sort of counseling for those individuals? Contact the agency. What do we do? Marie, let me start with you.
Sure. I think it starts with the orientation of staff when they first day on their job. They must learn about all the aspects of supporting somebody with intellectual disability, what the good parts are and what the risks are, and to learn about sex education, to learn about that these are not children, these are adults, to learn about looking for signs, looking for subtle changes in a person's communication. The things that now are reported, we've learned it was just something very subtle. We heard the story of the person in a group home. Somebody just walking by noticed a cigarette butt beside a bed. And what was that about? And the next thing, they were able to prosecute that case. So it is that training of that staff and an awareness with that staff. It is conversations routinely. It's not just a once when you came to the job, but it's also yearly. It's talking about people's rights to sexuality, but also thinking of sexual safety practices that you must have in the group home that are critical. I think a lot has happened since the 80s, but we still have far to go.
But what I think one of her main questions is, what do they know now if they have suspicions, or yes, so maybe they've witnessed something?
Sure. And I think it's really important when that first day, if you see anything that you have a question about, anything that you have a doubt about, anything that you feel uncomfortable with, you must report it to your supervisor. If they're not listening, you need to continue to report it. We need to be able to talk to people, because it's often that new employee that sees something that no one else noticed, mm-hmm. and really could be the person that could stop the abuse.
Can I interrupt just 1 second, Nancy? Do you have people who are mandatory reporters? I
mean, absolutely.
Since the Sandusky case, Pennsylvania has changed laws with who is a mandatory reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Who
are so are they trained? So all direct care staff, they are trained that they are mandatory reporters.
Secretary, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that the regulations that govern all of our programs require, and we measure whether they do, providers train direct care staff in how to report a full range of incidents, including sexual abuse. I think that, and they do, and the training happens, and we get lots of reports. I think that how that training is delivered is important. And that happens between each provider agency and their staff. And that's why I say that the solution here is a partnership solution. We can require things, we can put trainings out, but the actual delivery and the supervision of direct care staff is where that happens. And direct care staff often happen, having been a provider agency myself, the staff and agencies need not just to be reminded that they have an obligation to report, but they need to be invited to report. They need to understand that if they don't report, they're complicit. They need permission to report, because oftentimes they're reporting on coworkers and friends.
Yeah.
And so we really have to go the distance. And as I said, maybe dealing with their own trauma from their own history. So that relationship between the provider, the agency, and those direct care staff is where we can have a terrific impact on both protecting people and reporting.
And I just want to echo what she's saying there. When you are in a position of reporting a colleague or a friend, you have a suspicion there. The law says you report the suspicion and you allow trained professionals to investigate. Many people feel uncomfortable doing that and make the wrong decision in wanting to investigate on their own, to feel like, I know for sure now that I'm doing the right thing. And that can be a really difficult thing. So having the employer continually remind people, I love that language of inviting people to report, and reminding folks that it's suspicion of abuse that you are required to report. You are not required to do that investigation on your own. There are trained people to do that.
We had a phone call here from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. It says, how do we avoid this vulnerability from turning into a rush to sterilize or segregating the sexes? I mean, that would be, that brings up visions of
that's where we
going
were.
To, yeah, where we were.
So I think, you know, knee-jerk reactions are common, especially when people are horrified. And so this is a great question and a great opportunity to explain that sterilization doesn't change the abuse.
It doesn't change perpetration.
All it does is prevent pregnancy, and that's not the problem. The problem is this person was taken advantage of. They were abused, and that's what has to stop.
Mm. What about, I think this caller had another part, wondered if the guest would comment on LGBT issues associated with this as intellectual disabilities as well.
So the field of intellectual disabilities, and particularly in the area of sexuality, is always behind the rest of the culture. We are just catching up to the fact that people with intellectual disabilities and autism might be transgender, might be gay, might be confused about their gender. And given how much work we have to do just on acknowledging that people are sexual, we have a lot of work to do on the broader issues of sexual identity.
Something you said earlier that many parents don't like to think about their child who may have intellectual disabilities, maybe living with intellectual disabilities, as being an adult, being in a relationship, being in a sexual relationship. Sex education, and again, I keep referring back to the NPR story. They had some audio of a sex education course where a teacher asked, you know, what are you looking for? And basically what it came down to is people with intellectual disabilities want the same thing as those without intellectual disabilities. They want love. They want romance. They want a sexual relationship. But often they find it hard because of communication. A lot of them don't have friends. So how important is that sex education? And I got another question from a listener who asked, when you're speaking to a child with an intellectual disability, how is that conversation different than having the conversation about sex with one who doesn't have an intellectual disability? There's like five questions wrapped up into one.
Wow. Can I start with what we should do for families?
Yes.
Some of our chapters do amazing work with connecting families. So parents need to have these conversations. They need to be talking to each other when their children are very young. What are you doing? How is this working? But also as they're adults, how are you positioning your child to go off on their own? And how hard is that? Because you're now going to be worried about all these things that could happen. But to have those conversations among parent to parent, having honest conversations behind closed doors, well, I don't really want her to do any of those things. Well, you know, the other parent says, I didn't either. But here, you know, 10 years later, I'm here to say that it's worked out and this is what happened. So that's one of the key components, is having families talk to each other to be able to support each other.
Mm-hmm. I would just say that like for typical people, it starts when you're very young with learning about your body and honest conversations. And the rest of the world talks about sex their entire life, right? They talk to their friends about their relationships, intimate issues. And we need to create opportunities and environments at different ages for different ways to explore and learn and resolve issues. Seeing a counselor for some people makes sense. Having a peer group makes some sense. But keeping it as prominent in our programs, our daily life, as it is in our life. And it means overcoming our resistance to talking about it, our own embarrassment and our own discomfort. So we need a big oomph to do the right thing for people with intellectual disabilities that everybody else just does as part of their life.
And to that point, what we talk about, whether it's, you know, how do you talk to young children? How do you talk to teens? How do you talk to anybody about these issues in a developmentally appropriate way? Just a general reminder, if you are watching television, movies, listening to song lyrics, videos, video games, you are presented with a bazillion opportunities in your daily life to say, how does that word make you feel? Do people around you use that? What would you say if your friend got called that name? You know, you can interject learning opportunities in ways that are non-threatening, that are totally conversational and happen every day. So it's encouraging people to do those things.
You know, but I can just see how hard this is. And I'm going to give an example, Kristen. Larry Nassar case. in Michigan,
yes.
the Olympic team doctor, who victimized. I don't know if it's unprecedented, but having these victims face him and his sentencing mm-hmm. and talk about the impact that his sexual abuse had on them.
Yep.
Now, these were world-class athletes mm-hmm. who didn't know, as this guy was, you know, sexually assaulting them, some with their parents in the room
yep.
With a towel covering them, didn't know, well, he must know what he's doing. Okay, I bring that point up. It's not a one-on-one good comparison, but the point being is that it's hard for anyone yes. to have that conversation.
It is.
Let alone mm-hmm. having that conversation with a child or even an adult who is living with intellectual disabilities.
But the point is, the more that we make it normal to talk about those things and the more that adults or trusted caretakers present that opportunity, I'm willing to talk about it, I'm going to ask about it, I am paying attention. Those things are subtle indicators that it's okay to have the conversation about it. So it's, you know, there is no foolproof. I mean, my goodness, our agency, if there was a foolproof method, like one thing everybody could do that would stop perpetration, we would be on that. This is human behavior. And people who are committing sexual offenses are often very skilled at being manipulative, and that is part of how they gain access to repeated incidents with one person, repeated incidents with multiple people. So we have to keep in mind this is human behavior we're dealing with. But we all have our own human behavior too. And there are many, those little things that we can all do in our day-to-day work can alter the environment to make it okay to talk about those things. If it feels risky, that's going to silence people.
We only have about a minute left. I want to thank the three of you. There's so much more we could talk about today, but I'm glad that we are able to bring this conversation to Central Pennsylvania and get people talking about it, get people thinking about it. From this show, Secretary Thaler, and the NPR series, which again, I encourage everyone to listen to, what do you want people to take away from that? And I have about 30 seconds or so.
That every single person in whatever role they have, has a responsibility not to forget this story and to think about what they will do, whether they're an agency executive director, whether they're a parent, whether they're a direct care staff person, whether they're a neighbor that has somebody next door, that we are all responsible for not just keeping people safe, but making sure they have a really good life.
I want to thank the three of you for being with us today. Great conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
Coming up on tomorrow's show, we have the new mayor of York will be appearing on the program. Obviously, there's a lot in the news right now that we are looking at. In fact, understand that there's a police incident in Harrisburg today, and we'll see if we can dig up anything new on that and possibly discuss it on tomorrow's program as well. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, committed to reducing hospital-acquired infections and readmission rates. More information on UPMC Pinnacle's achievements in patient safety can be found at upmcpinnacle.com/quality.